Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police changed something in America. In recent years, deaths of African Americans by police across the country have resulted in localized protests. But this time they took place in every major city in the country, along with smaller communities, Charlotte among them.
I can't breathe! I can't breathe! I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
Sounds from the streets of Charlotte. Considering the number of people involved in these protests, it can be safely said most demonstrators were peaceful and well-intentioned. But as we all know, many cities, including this one, experienced violence and destruction of property. Most people who witness wrongs and are outraged by them don't protest, no matter how appalled they may be. So what drives those that do to become so involved? What did these demonstrators hope would come from their involvement? What do they believe they achieved? And what do they hope the next steps will be? We're joined this hour by a man who first came into the public consciousness in Charlotte during the 2016 protest following the shooting by CMPD of Keith Lamont Scott. Braxton Winston went on to become a Charlotte City Council member at large, and this past Friday night was on the street, arrested and charged with failure to disperse upon command during a protest on Beatty's Ford Road, and he joins us for the hour. Welcome back to the program, Braxton.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for having me again.
You're welcome. Another Charlotte City Councilman, Malcolm Graham, is with us. He was also involved in Friday's protests, and he, too, is here this morning rejoining us again. Thank you for being on the program.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Reverend Jay Leach was on the streets with protesters on Friday night, a minister at Unitarian Universalist Church in Charlotte. He has been involved in social justice as a white ally for many, many years. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. And Alvin Jacobs is a Charlotte-based photographer and activist who has been capturing images of protests for years, about 10 years, as a matter of fact. He was doing just that over the weekend in Minneapolis and other locations, and he joins us from his hometown. I've already forgotten where you are this morning. Alvin, where are you this morning?
I'm in Rockford, Illinois.
Rockford, Illinois. Braxton, let me start with you. You gained notoriety, as I said, with your shirtless photograph on the front page of the paper during the Keith Lamont Scott protest and your efforts to keep things calm at that protest. You stood in between the police and demonstrators. But on Friday, you're doing exactly the same thing. And you were arrested for your involvement, as I said, on charges of failure to disperse upon command. So let me hear your side of this. Why were you arrested? What was going on?
Well, I didn't arrest myself, so I can't tell you why I was arrested.
What did they tell you? What did they tell you?
They didn't tell me anything. I won't get too much into the details about the arrest because I am in a legal proceeding. But I will say that I wasn't necessarily doing the same thing that I was doing in September 2016. I had many different roles in September 2016. I was out there because I was angry. As I got out there, the first time I had ever been out to a protest, I learned a lot real fast, and I took on different roles. I was pushed forth as a leader. I helped keep the groups together. I helped mediate so that we can keep our protests going. I was a photographer. I was a documenter, right? I was a citizen journalist showing images that weren't being shown by other media outlets. It's a little different on Friday. I was not necessarily out there to protest. I wasn't protesting. That's not my role anymore, because why would I be protesting when I am the person or I am the entity now that is making the changes? Why would I go out there and yell at the police department, which I administer and which I have a check and balance over? I should go into the mirror and yell. So what I was doing out there was to try to de-escalate the situation. De-escalation means to bring the temperature down, to keep it somewhat civil, so everybody can get home safe at the end of the night. It wasn't to tell CMPD how to do their job. It wasn't to tell people how to protest. That was not allowed to happen. CMPD, I believe, decided, and as the chiefs told me last night, that the time they had given up on de-escalation, at least at that point in time, and at that place, and decided that I didn't have a role there that was constructive, and they arrested me. At the same time, they say there's always time for de-escalation. So let me
jump in there for a second, because right after you were released on Friday night from police custody, you posted on your Facebook page that you were there in your official capacity as a member of city council in an attempt to, as we've been talking about, to de-escalate the tensions between police and the citizens of Charlotte. Last night at city council, you had what has been described, at least in the paper, I didn't witness it, a tense conversation with Deputy Chief Johnny Jennings from CMPD, who will become the chief of police following Kerr Putney's retirement after the Republican National Convention, in which essentially he told you what you just said, that the time for a de-escalation was over. Who trumps whom in this situation? You're a member of city council. You're an elected official. You are the supervisory board over the police. I watched the video. There's an aerial photograph. There's an aerial video of you in between protesters and police, and you were essentially stormed by the police and taken to the ground.
I don't think that this is a time for elbowing out of who's more powerful and who should have more power. I think the point is de-escalation, right? What are we doing here? After Keith Lamont Scott, I know the Charlotte City Council, the whole entire organization of the Charlotte government, the business community, the faith community, we've had all these conversations, all this money spent on de-escalation. When those difficult times come and de-escalation is actually needed, that call is immediately abandoned by CMPD. And I think that is the problem and the question here. What should we really expect from our government to stand by in terms of what our values are and what kind of pact do we have between citizens and our government? We've been saying one thing for 4 years, but when the rubber has again hit the road, we've abandoned all of that talk and all of that those efforts.
Malcolm Graham, you're a member of city council. You also are part of the body that governs the police. What's your take on all of this? Do you echo his sentiments, or do you have a different take on it?
Well, thank you, Mike, for having me today. As you know, I represent the Bayswater Road Corridor in West Charlotte. I was out there myself for about 3 to 4 hours, really trying to protect the public interest of my neighborhood leaders and those in the community who live there. Bayswater Road is a corridor, but it's also a residential area as well. And so it was certainly disconcerting to a number of the residents that live in the area. I think Mr. Winston and the CMPD will get together and resolve their differences. I don't want to do it here on the ear, and nor do I want to take attention away from why the protesters were on the streets in the first place. Racism, discrimination, hatred, police accountability, a black man getting killed in Minnesota, a white woman in New York weaponizing her whiteness against a black man, a jogger in Atlanta being trapped and killed, my sister celebrating her 5th anniversary in heaven, who was killed in Emmanuel AME Church by a white supremacist. The issue in our country is hatred, racism, discrimination. And what happened in Charlotte, it was part of a national demonstration where people have said they had enough. Our president talks about barking dogs. Our president talks about looting and shooting. Our president used the federal government to clear a peaceful protest so that he can make a photo op. So the issue is much bigger than what's happening here in Charlotte. We have a national concern, and my job as a council member is to protect the public interest in Charlotte, giving space for those who want to peacefully protest to do that. They have a right to be there. They should be protesting and pushing back. but they should do so in a lawful manner.
Let's talk about the spark that ignited all of this across the country. And that, of course, was the murder of George Floyd. And let's call it a murder because the mayor of Minneapolis has called it that. And I believe the police chief up there has called it that. Let's call it something else. We don't use this word very much anymore. But was his murder, Malcolm, a modern day lynching?
Yes, it was. There's no other way to categorize what happened there. For 9 minutes, nine awful long minutes, the nation watched this man's life be snapped away from him by an individual in the color of law, in uniform. It was a murder, plain and simple. Those who watched that were also in uniform failed to provide any type of support for someone who needed help. We have a racism problem in our country, and we need to acknowledge that. We need to talk about that, and we need to protest that. I agree, but we have to protest that with our mind, our will, and the power of our vote to make changes. Certainly local government has to do its fair share. Charlotte is not immune from issues relating to police violence. But I have to, you know, again, I was there. The City of Charlotte Police Department didn't escalate the violence on the street. They were protecting themselves. They were under attack. And so people can disagree in terms of what they saw, but that's what I saw. And they had an opportunity, yet a responsibility to protect themselves, protect public property, and more importantly, to protect the residents who live along the corridor. And so I think if we're going to be honest brokers, we must speak truth to power. We must tell the truth. And we must, again, criticize police when they do wrong. I criticize, condemn what happened in Charlotte before, what happened in Minnesota weeks ago. But we also must, again, acknowledge when the police officers are acting within the scope of their responsibility.
So, Jay Leach, you have been involved in a lot of these protests over the years as a white ally and as a leader of the spiritual community. And one of the things that we have seen all across the country is a lot of white faces scattered in among the African-American faces who are protesting and marching, most of them marching peacefully. I want to get everybody's perspective on this, but I'd like to hear from you, Reverend, about what it was about this time that made this murder a catalyst for almost revolution. You could almost call it revolution. They haven't been this kind of marching in the streets since the 60s.
I'm not sure anybody knows the full analysis on that, but I can make some suppositions. I think one thing is the graphic nature of the murder itself. How rapidly the video circulated and people had access. We need to remember that there was a police narrative about what took place in broad daylight on a public street in Minneapolis. There was a police story being told. The police story filed in a report was this was a man who was resisting arrest, and we used the force that was necessary to subdue him. I think once people put those two things together, that the police are telling a story that the video clearly and the supporting videos clearly showed was not true. Then, as we find out yesterday, there's a whole other story that we should get into about how this man died. What was the cause of his death? So I think as people start to understand that, this raises a different level of consciousness.
We have much more conversation ahead. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Braxton Winston, City Councilman-at-Large, Malcolm Graham, City Council District 2, Reverend Jay Leach, Minister at Unitarian Universalist Church, and Alvin Jacobs, a photographer, a local photographer who has gained national attention for his coverage of the murders and killings of African-Americans for about 10 years now. I want to come back to something that you were talking about just before the break, Reverend, about this autopsy report, that we have conflicting autopsy reports. I want to get to that in a second, but I also want to hear from Alvin Jacobs, who you've been covering the aftermath of these killings for 10 years, a decade. What is different about this one?
Oh, man. I've never seen anything like the organization over so many cities. It was one thing for Ferguson to react in Ferguson. It was one thing for Brooklyn to react in Brooklyn. It was one thing for Chicago to react in Chicago and Charlotte and Charlotte and so on and so on. But to have such a widespread level of frustration, and I have to be very, 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 very careful with my words. I've never seen anything like this in my life. And I thought Charlottesville was the most, you know. This is a level of frustration I've never seen. And I'm using that word very, very, very carefully. It was so widespread. Almost every single individual I talked to, and I spoke with hundreds, everyone can articulate the way that I can, or maybe that Braxton can, or maybe that Jay can. And a lot of folks in different cities are upset that they feel their options have been exhausted. People aren't listening to the vote. People aren't listening to the begging and the pleading, and maybe God isn't necessarily listening to the prayer. So reacting physically and violently, if they're not going to listen to our bodies, they're going to listen to the money. People have been taught to follow the money in almost every single aspect of life. If you don't care about anything, you care about commerce. That's why buildings are being protected, not people. Buildings are being protected in communities. So if you destroy the buildings, they're going to listen to your voice.
And as some observers have pointed out, it's a law of physics that if you don't let the steam out, it will, the vessel containing the steam will explode. And that, I think, is what's happening here in large part. You're too young to remember, Alvin, the protests and demonstrations that revolved around Vietnam and the killings of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy in the 1960s and Kent State. You, however, Reverend, I believe are probably not too young to remember that, as I look at you on Zoom here this morning. Is there a parallel? He's never seen anything like this before, but there was an undercurrent of anger in the 1960s, different from this, except when you relate it to the civil rights protests. What's different about this? Is it because of COVID-19 and being cooped up and losing jobs and having no income? Is it because of a long series of travesties perpetrated on African Americans? Is it because there's just an undercurrent of anger throughout the culture?
I think the continuity that many of us are learning is 400 years of white supremacy, layered on top of layered on top of layer. So for me, I'm less interested in distinguishing this, setting this apart, and recognizing this as the latest layer of the attempt in a variety of ways to call out the inherent white supremacy in our culture and the implications of the white supremacy in our culture on the way we police. I think it's very important that we not lose sight of the aspect of policing in this. Just as we experienced here in 2016, remembering that what lit the spark of the uprising was this immense frustration with the way some people are policed. And I think what we're experiencing again is, on one hand, as Alvin points to, the frustration of the way some people are policed, and on the other hand, a growing recognition on the part of people that aren't policed that way that certain people are. They're starting to believe our co-conspirators in this. We're starting to believe them when they tell us we're policed this way.
And although it may start with the police, it's not just the police, and it's not even just the criminal justice system. It's spread throughout the culture. But let's talk about the criminal justice system, because, Reverend, you brought up something that just was revealed to us yesterday. The Minneapolis Medical Examiner has one autopsy report that says he died from underlying causes. He did not die from asphyxiation or strangulation, even though an officer's knee was on his neck for 9 minutes. A private medical examiner, hired by the family of George Floyd, says he did die of asphyxiation. So we have these two different tales of what the cause of death was. It speaks to something in the culture. Are we saying that the medical examiner is just as at fault as the officer who put his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck, Braxton?
So when I was on Beatty's Ford Road a few minutes before I was arrested, I was listening to the folks that were from Beatty's Ford Road that were out there. And there's a quote that has resonated with me that has been playing in my head. If you want us to get rid of the street code, then you need to get rid of the police code. And this is a code that is inherent and is built on those layer by layer by layer throughout different forms of government, right? Yes, it does extend to the medical examiners. It extends through my organization, right? And that's not just a city function. This is a state function, right? In our city charter, right after they named the city of Charlotte, they said they point out that police officers cannot be fired by any municipal administrator. It has to go through this citizen appointed board, right? So we don't even have the power to do these things. We learned after Dan Quirius Franklin, within by accident, that CMPD was holding their own attorneys in their organization, protecting them from the city attorney's office and that budget and that oversight. So yes, this is something that is inherent and ingrained within all of our institutions. You can always shoehorn police behavior to being good by policy and by law. Look at the Dan Quirius Franklin shooting. The chief and the city manager have agreed that shooting was justified. They can say that it was wrong all they want, but they're saying that it's justified so that it is by policy. So I asked the city manager and the city chief, okay, if this is by our city policy, then is this how we are training folks at the academy to handle this situation? Because in your public statement, you're saying there's nothing wrong here by policy. We should be able to do this. So is that how you're training? And you don't really get a straight answer because it's wrong, but it is protected by the way we have formed our institutions.
Let me ask the elephant in the room question, because there may be people on the other side of this conversation who are appalled by the violence and the destruction and are on the side of the president in terms of how he would like to take action against all of this. So let me ask about the elephant in the room. I believe I'm accurate in saying that the chief of police in Minneapolis is an African-American. We have a black police chief here. We have a deputy who's about to take over who's also black. We have a black district attorney. We have a black city manager. Are you saying that they are in on this, that they are de facto agreeing with these policies?
Yeah, I'm going to go right into this. So, yeah, we can have an academic discussion where I can show you, regardless of the people or the individuals you place into a system, that doesn't change the system. The system is still racist. But yes, you're absolutely right. And on the other side, we are the ones, you know, I don't tell people how to protest, but me and my colleagues are the ones you need to be protesting. Why? Because we are the ones that have the power to change this. And you do have all of these black people in authority who haven't made the necessary changes. It is not academic of how we can change, can change this. Malcolm and I are two of 11 people who control every line of police spending. And we are the ones who hire the manager who oversees the police chief and that policy. And we have refused to make those changes that can be done with 6 votes. So it is a both end. It is academic. Yes, it still is a racist system, but we are as black leaders not doing enough.
You're getting a lot
and
of
if
not,
I,
go ahead.
If I can jump in, Braxton, as you well know, I mean, one of the things that people are saying is why is this happening? This is the same narrative that we had in 2016. Some of us went to council. Some of us went to the mayor then and said, please conduct an independent investigation of the tactics of CMPD during the uprising. Those of us who were out on the streets who saw what happened, particularly in that highly volatile second night of the uprising, know what the police did. We were standing beside them. We watched what they did. And some of us went that night, early the next morning, met with the mayor and with members of city council and urged them to do an independent investigation of CMPD and the policing tactics that we saw in the streets. What happened right away is there was a pivot and the chief of police was allowed to come before city council and recommend an organization, a very police-friendly organization, that was going to investigate the policing.
Police Foundation.
Was long overdue. And when it finally came out, it basically that was problematic.
And when I got on city council, on a community safety committee, I suggested and I moved to create a process where we can critique and go through CMPD policies proactively and reactively when things happen, and to set it up through the committee system. My committee members, my colleagues, did not see the value in it, and we did not assert our power to be able to do that. I will continue to push that, but we have not been willing to do that.
Malcolm. I'm going to take it in a little different direction, and I'm not saying that I disagree with my colleague or RJ. I think we are dealing with institutional racism. It's the institution, whether it's healthcare, whether it's the judicial system, whether it's the criminal justice system, whether it's the education system. It doesn't matter who heads the organization, it's embedded into the organization. And I think we ought to call it what it is, that racism probably is a public health crisis. You know, I think we got to do that. But again, as I said earlier, I'm going to pivot because, again, we can talk about the CMPD. We can talk about tactics. That means we're still talking about the rioting, right? And I want to get to why the people were out there in the first place, right? And that's because all over the country, even here in Charlotte in the past, unarmed Black men are being needlessly killed by police officers. Churchgoers are being killed by white supremacists. People are weaponizing their race against another, and people are fed up and tired. That's the issue for me. I think that's the issue for a number of people across the nation. And so certainly as a council, we have a role to play in terms of how we police our police department. In the last 4 years, we have made some gains. We have a hell of a lot more work to do in terms of police community relationships, working with our ministers and those on the ground to make positive change. And again, policy decisions that at the end of the day require 6 votes. And so I want to focus the conversation, the national conversation, and we talked about policing. We can talk about, if you want to see a police department or a government push back on its citizens, then you just need to watch the tapes from last night in D.C. It is a national problem, and we got more issues than as a country, even here in Charlotte, as we prepare for a convention in August, and that certainly will bring a lot of attention from a whole lot of folks in terms of how do we protect the public safety? How do we protect citizens and residents? Or how do we protect our community and our city?
Alvin, I know you've wanted to get on this since the very beginning of Braxton's comments, so go ahead.
We've been asking for our white allies for years to help us fight. Black men and women can be as loud as we want. We can be as agitated and angry and as frustrated as we want, and we just become angry Negroes, right? Unless white people stand with us the way that we're standing visibly, not just with thoughts and prayers, I mean, placing their bodies literally on the line, nothing's going to change. In my hometown, we're often asked, well, what are you doing for Rockford? That's the pushback whenever you're asked a question. Well, hey, you know, law enforcement, hey, education, hey, you know, the infrastructure, well, what are you doing for Rockford? Unless you're a member of privilege, right? Unless you have access to resources, there's almost nothing you can do. You're always going to be at the bottom end of change. So when you have a whole lot of people saying the same thing, you develop a power structure that now equals the individuals who are oppressing the system. Now, what's interesting is that we have to be very careful in the individuals we allow the loudest voice. If black and brown people are saying, stop killing us, that's the underlying issue. Stop killing us. Roughly 1,000 folks are killed every single year by members of law enforcement in this country. 1,000, give or take. Could be 1,100, could be 900 and something, but roughly 1,000 people. And folks will say, well, that's not a big deal. This amount of people die from cancer. This amount of people die from car accident. This amount of people die from alcohol. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about a system that will not be tried, will not be convicted. They can do whatever they want as a system, and there's nothing we can do about it. When we start seeing white people, right, being treated the way that black people are being treated, things are going to change. That's why it's so important to see this widespread anger and frustration and protest. Yes, some people are taking it to the extreme. And guess what? The world is paying attention. Because when we asked you and we begged and we pleaded and we prayed to please stop killing us, you kept going. So what's indicative of those minutes, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. And I mean 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. That's what we're going through. We're like, hey, guys, please stop killing us. I can't breathe. 2 minutes. Guys, please stop killing us, begging and praying. 3 minutes to 4 minutes, it keeps going. That ninth minute, when the world started to burn, now they're like, well, wait a minute, what do you want? What I'm saying to people who I come in contact with are, we have to have a plan. We have to have a plan because the world is listening now. I'm not saying don't protest. I'm not saying don't riot. And that's something, too. We keep saying this isn't a riot. What's wrong with a riot? What's wrong with a riot? Right. We want to protest peacefully. We want everyone to respect our humanity, but that isn't being respected. But they're paying attention and they're damn sure respecting the riot. So what if we embrace what's working? Right. What if we remove the respectability politics, right, from around African-Americans, right, with great education and access to resources and high credit levels? Right. And we just get down to the nitty gritty. Like Jay said, it's racism. We have to call it what it is. Like our city manager said, it's racism. Like Braxton said, it's racism. Now you're listening to the racism. Whatever it takes to get to that point, in my opinion, it is what it is. Businesses can be rebuilt, right? Systems must be destroyed and lives cannot be brought back. We have to pick a struggle.
Alvin Jacobs is a photographer who's been covering the aftermath of these killings of black men for 10 years. He's with us with Braxton Winston and Malcolm Graham from City Council and the Reverend Jay Leach from Unitarian Universalist Church. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the protests and, in some cases, riots that have erupted around the country, including here in Charlotte, as the result of the death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police, and what has made this different, and where we are today as a country and as a people in terms of our understanding of institutional racism and a history of it in our country for 400 years. Braxton Winston is here. He is a city councilman at large. Malcolm Graham, City Council District 2. The Reverend Jay Leach, minister with Unitarian Universalist Church and a white ally. And Alvin Jacobs, who is a well-known photographer who has made a name for himself documenting the aftermath of the killings of African-American men at the hands of police. We have a number of emails and comments coming in from people about how this should be handled and why this one is different. Comment on Facebook, why is this one different? It's really easy to rationalize a police shooting because it is an instant decision, and many people understand how, in a situation like that, mistakes can be made. This looked deliberate, prolonged, torturous, inhumane. That, I believe, is why this is seen so differently. And another writer talks about calling out the National Guard and putting police into military gear is the opposite of what is needed. We need to see that changes will happen with the cooperation of community leaders who have also been too quiet. I'm disappointed in the lack of positive actions, and I am white, 60-year-old woman. I understand why people are so angry that nothing is being done. I want to talk about leadership, but I also want to echo or underline her comments by playing back a piece of tape that was recorded yesterday. This is prior to the president's address at the White House before he walked across the street for a photo op at a church. This was at a call to the nation's governors, a conversation with the nation's governors. This went on for 7 minutes before the governors got in with their own questions. And we've edited this down, so we can't go for 7 minutes, but this is the President of the United States.
We're strongly looking for arrests. You have to get much tougher. You have to dominate. If you don't dominate, you're wasting your time. They're going to run over you. You're going to look like a bunch of jerks. You have to dominate. And you have to arrest people, and you have to try people. And they have to go to jail for long periods of time. And those kids, they're all on camera, the wise guys. And it's coming from the radical left. So you have them on tape, you have them on television. In history, there's never been anybody taped so much committing a crime. You got to arrest all those people. And you got to try them. And if they get 5 years or 10 years, they have to get 5 years or 10 years. There's no retribution. So I say that, and the winners dominate. If you don't dominate your city and your state, they're going to walk away with you. And we're doing it in Washington and D.C. We're going to do something that people haven't seen before. But you're going to have total domination.
Now that went on for 7 minutes with a lot of repetition because the president likes to repeat himself. His base, I would think, would agree with everything he says and would agree with what actions have been taken around the country. And they would agree with not only militarizing the police departments around the country, but bringing in federal troops, which I believe is unconstitutional and illegal due to posse comitatus, which was passed in the 1800s to prevent the military from operating on United States soil. That aside, is that the problem? Is what he said the problem? It harkens back to Richard Nixon. Is that the problem?
I say it is the problem. The problem is that all of that, what he said, is possible and protected. You know, you can ratchet it up. You know, you can ratchet it up and you can make it fit the narrative and make it fit into history. And that's what has been done time and time again. That's how the narrative gets controlled. The only way that you flip that is by changing up the rules to the game. And again, we have the ability to do that, you know?
So how do you, in the face of these protests started peacefully, and I think the majority of people on the streets around America were involved in peacefully protesting what they see as a dreadful injustice. But then there are elements that get out of control and cause property destruction and risk people's lives in the process. So how do you have a conversation with a President Trump or with people who agree with President Trump on his get tough position in the face of that?
Well, the breadcrumbs of racism and discrimination leads right into the Oval Office itself. So let's put that on the table and be clear about that from my perspective. Certainly, we have a responsibility yet an obligation to protect citizens, and all the protests last night, for an example, in D.C., was a peaceful protest until the president himself escalated by clearing the streets with horses and moving people away to provide him an opportunity for a photo op. We don't want to militarize our police department. Certainly, we don't want to have to call out the National Guard. But it's important that we as a community are prepared for these incidents. We want to give protesters the space and the freedom to articulate their concerns, give them the streets to protest injustice, which is occurring in our community. But when that gets out of hand, when it takes a turn, just like in 2016, where the city was certainly caught off guard, ill-prepared, I think proper preparation prevents poor planning. That is something that we do not want to do. We should not want to have the military on our streets, certainly not the federal government on our streets. But certainly, I think as a community here in Charlotte, we need to, again, be honest brokers and be realistic about what's happening on the ground. I want to give every opportunity, every space, every commitment from the city to allow protesters to have their say and do what they have to do, because I agree with them 100%. But when it takes the turn, when life, liberty, property, and more importantly, citizens are at risk, then I think the government, the local government, the police department must fulfill their fiduciary responsibility.
I gotta jump in there because there's a hypocrisy there. In one sense, you say we don't want to militarize our police, but again, we're the ones, Malcolm and I are the ones militarizing our police. We have the ability to demilitarize our police, and we don't take that, but we'll say things, you know, when we're on shows like this to answer certain questions. The president,
it's not an
either or. The mayor on Saturday called out the National Guard before the president did, you know, and my son, who was at that press conference when that happened, the first thing his eyes said, well, the president said that we should call out the military to shoot people. And so we are employing the same tactics behind the scenes, but my colleagues still believe that it is the reason why we resolved stuff in September of 2016 is because the National Guard was called out. Anybody that was on the street knows that that is not the case. That was because of leadership in the community, yeah. Making relationships with CMPD and figuring things out. But the 12 people that are still making decisions still believe that it was the National Guard. And we are getting ahead for bringing the National Guard here because that, to them, constitutes a plan to de-escalate the tensions, and it doesn't make sense.
Both Alvin and Jay want to get in on this. Hold on just a second, but I want to let Malcolm Graham, because he's also on City Council, and a lot of allegations have been put down here in this last few minutes. So what's your response to that? Are you part of the problem? Is City Council part of the problem?
No, and people can disagree about how we get to a certain destination. So Branston and I are in the same zip code. We just kind of from a different perspective. Again, it takes 14 hours to get the National Guard on the ground. And so, yes, the mayor called for the National Guard. They were assembled, not in uptown, assembled far, far away to be ready if needed. They were not needed. So it's called preparation planning, because we don't know how this thing is going to take a turn. And so we have to be able to do both, right? Give the protesters the opportunity to express their constitutional rights, to push back hard with them. Again, I understand racism and discrimination. My sister, again, was killed by a white supremacist. So I get it. I understand it. I'm with them. But you also have to protect the public space as well. And so it's not an either or. I think you can do both. And I think this is how you manage the 15th largest city in the country. You just can't hope that something doesn't go wrong. Hope is not a strategy.
So let me bring Alvin and Jay into this. Both want to comment. Alvin, go ahead.
Yes, sir. So I just got a knock on my door, and I think it was a very large elephant. A couple of weeks ago, there have been hundreds, literally hundreds of white folks carrying guns on state property, on public property, and everyone was protesting peacefully. So what is it about?
You're referring to people in Michigan State Capitol who were referring protesting the lockdown of their economy by the Michigan governor, and they were white people, and they brought AK-47s and other semi-automatic weapons to the state house, into the state house chambers. They were not arrested.
Yelling at police officers, getting all up in the officers' faces. You understand what I'm saying? And nothing happened. See, that's not seen as violent, right? But you get a couple of black folks who are, you know, angry and frustrated, and there's more of us than there are of them, and the narrative changes. See, what I need to tell you is that I'm on the ground for real. I'm not seeing protesters harming other protesters, right? There's no violence there, right? You aren't seeing individuals being harmed and physically assaulted. That's not happening. That's being done by members of law enforcement. So if we're talking about violence, let's just talk about what it is. It's damage to commercial property. Let's just say that, right? Let's just say exactly what it is. So there's something inherently more violent, right, about a black unarmed body than it is with a white man with a very large weapon. We aren't talking about that enough. Protest peacefully. Protest peacefully. If I'm walking down the street right now in my hometown of Rockford, Illinois, right? Now, granted, this isn't an open carry state. You can walk out here if you want to with a chopper, and it's going to be a problem. But if it was, I cannot do that. You understand what I'm saying? I cannot do the same thing a white person can do. My body inherently is seen as violent, right? I'm seen as overly aggressive. I'm a problem. My voice is a problem. My skin is a problem. That's what people are saying. There's hundreds of white folks who are telling you what they're going to do. In every chat room, they're saying, well, we're not going to take violence off the table. We're going to do what we got to do. They keep saying well-regulated militia. They keep threatening with the amount of guns. You'll see a white guy with hundreds of guns, you know, in his home. This is what I have to work with. And we keep getting accused of being violent. We keep being accused of having guns. Look what just happened in Atlanta. That brother and that sister was pulled out of their vehicle because someone said gun in a state where you can have a gun. What's the problem?
We had a recent problem here in North Carolina with the husband of the reopened North Carolina protest movement who essentially said murder is not off the table. We will kill somebody to get ourselves open, and I don't believe he's under arrest, nor has he been declared to be a terrorist, as the president has declared protesters to be terrorists. Jay.
One of the most finely crafted and maintained lies in our nation's history is that white people need to fear the violence from black people. And the maintenance of that narrative, Malcolm, you see it in your neighborhood. I heard a realtor here talk about the dangerous part of town. The reaction that you have from folks, as Alvin says, simply the encounter with a black person is perceived as violence. I think if we're going to have a conversation about violence, we have to unpack that and recognize how we flipped the narrative, how the narrative's always been, the truth has always been, black people have always had way more to fear from white violence. We don't tell that story. The other thing, I was a fully grown man before I learned during the uprising that you can do violence to a building. I always thought violence had a human quality to it. As Alvin said, there may be property destruction, but where is the violence? The other piece that's important to recognize, and Mike, I think this is to your point about what's different. This is during a pandemic in which I watched my nurse neighbor across the street rinse out a mask so that she could take it back into a hospital and use it again. When you look on our streets right now at what the police have access to, I haven't seen a single person out there lacking a mask. They have appeared in our streets as an occupying army. One that got $50 million federal grant for the DNC, one that's getting additional $50 million grant from the RNC in addition to the budget. So when we see all of this, we have to reframe what violence looks like. What does violence look like? When you come down my street looking like an occupying army, and that's not violence, but my shouting at you gives you permission to shoot me with projectiles. We've watched our friends on the street. We know what's actually happening out there. They are shooting people with projectiles on the streets of Charlotte. But that's not violent.
That is Reverend Jay Leach, minister at Unitarian Universalist Church. He's joining us along with Alvin Jacobs, a photographer, Malcolm Graham from City Council, and Braxton Winston, also from City Council. Because of the extraordinary nature of this conversation and the extraordinary nature of what's going on in the world, we are going to continue this conversation into the next hour for those of you listening to our live broadcast in the morning. And we will continue that conversation in just a moment. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. We're back to Charlotte Talks. We will join a 1A in progress a little bit later on in the next hour. We're here with Braxton Winston and Malcolm Graham from Charlotte City Council, Reverend Jay Leach from Unitarian Universalist Church, and Alvin Jacobs, who is a photographer who has documented the ongoing violence, the demonstrations, in this country following the violent deaths of black men who are, for the most part, unarmed. And it should be also pointed out, for the most part, the demonstrations, most of the demonstrators in this and every other incident have been peaceful. When these demonstrations turn violent, people often say that this is the only way, and I think one of you said it today, this is the only way we can get people to take notice. When we put graffiti on buildings or we break windows, that's when they notice us. That's when they think, well, there's a problem here. Where's the balancing point? Where's the fine line? Alvin.
This may be a couple of days ago on Twitter, that now would be a perfect time for either an alien invasion, right, or for a country, right, to come see about us. Right now, we are in such disarray, right? You know how easy it is to hijack a narrative? If you're walking with 100 people and one person comes in who you don't know and throws a Molotov cocktail, right, throws a water bottle and runs, 99 people's lives are now in danger. It could be 99 nuns. You understand what I'm saying? It could be 99 elderly senior citizens, grandmothers. Those 99 individuals' lives are now in danger if we're talking in confrontation with law enforcement. So when you have, and I'm going to use the word very carefully, outside agitators or just maybe folks who want to see the world burn. Braxton is a member of city council. You understand what I'm saying? He was treated like he wasn't in his official capacity, right? The organization of the protests that happened in Charlotte last night was beautiful. It was amazing. And because everyone was watching, right, nothing happened until later. So when I'm in these cities, man, nothing happens during the day. Everyone's walking. Everyone's marching peacefully. Everything's amazing. It's under the cover of darkness. Individuals that come in who have an outside agenda, right, who can do something, and now everyone else is now, they're in the same boat. I'm seeing photographers get arrested. I'm seeing photographers be abused, right? Videographers, members of the media. We saw a member of CNN arrested after he presented his credentials. This is something that we've never seen before, and we aren't calling it what it is. We're silencing our media. That's a problem, right? Mike, if you and I were in Minneapolis together, you're going to watch some things happen to me you're going to be very uncomfortable with if I continue going, even though I'm marching peacefully. And we're making the designation between buildings being burned and water bottles being thrown. They keep saying projectiles. There's something about something being thrown with the accuracy of a hand and something moving a few thousand feet a second. There's a difference between projectiles. I mean, you can throw a kitten, you know, not far, but it's a projectile, right? It's a little bit different, man, from these rubber bullets that are actually not so rubber at all. When you start seeing a lot of these projectiles being picked up, yep, there's one right there. How did that get there, Bracken? Did you buy that? Where'd you get? Is that the pepper?
Is a pepper ball round that police CMPD was firing into Romare Bearden Park last night indiscriminately. I was standing on Poplar Street and Third, and they were shooting down the block, just shooting indiscriminately, bunch of kids. Yes, there might have been, like you said, some outside agitators or people doing the wrong thing previously to that. But as one of the points I was trying to get at last night, individuals, if they're suspected of committing crimes, you go and get those individuals. You know, you don't shoot at me because I'm walking to the halal cart, you know, at the time that I want to go get something to eat and you feel threatened. You feel threatened by somebody else. That's the point here. You can de-escalate a situation and then continue on. But CMPD and other police departments around the country have said, once that we hit a point, we will no longer de-escalate and we don't care what you think or what you want to do. And that's the problem here.
We have witnessed around the country. I remember going to Italy in the early 1980s and being shocked at the carabinieri carrying automatic weapons on the streets of Rome. Shocked at it because I'd never seen anything like that. Police departments don't do that. Well, they do today. They do now. We have witnessed the militarization of our police force. In fact, excess military equipment is sold by the Defense Department to police forces around the country. And because this city has hosted the Democratic National Convention and plans to host the Republican Convention, additional money has already been brought up, has been given to beef up the kinds of support police officers have at their disposal. Now, the argument has been made that the police are outgunned by people on the streets, that people on the streets have more automatic weapons than the police have, and that's probably true. But talk about the effect of the militarization of our police department and the militarization of their tactics. Something that city council people, I guess, control to a certain degree, Malcolm. I know that Braxton 100%. Believes that we need to demilitarize police officers and look at public safety not as a violent act, and he wants to zero out budget lines for things like tear gas and chemical weapons. Are you on the same page?
No. Listen, I get it. I understand it. But I believe that there's room for both sides of the argument. As I said earlier, when you look at our police department, our police departments across the country, Charlotte being the 15th largest city in the country, that we have a unique special obligation between the council and the community. The community, black, white, rich, poor, young, old, all want to exercise life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They all want to walk the streets of Charlotte to feel protected. They all want to walk the streets of Charlotte and be able to protest when they feel that it's necessary. So I think there is room for both. I am not a chief of police. I am not a security expert. My job as a policy expert is to provide the resources for the city budget, to approve that budget, to then hand that budget over to the city manager and the chief of police, and to work in concert with them to decide the best short and long-term strategy for the community. Whether or not they need tear gas, whether or not they need chemical weapons, whether or not they need rubber bullets, I'm going to work with them and to provide them the resources to staff and to furnish the department as they see fit to protect the public safety. So it's not a matter of do they have these equipment. The question is, how do they use them? That's the question that we should be talking about versus whether or not they have them or not. How are they utilizing those assets and when should they utilize those assets? So I think that's the question that we should be focusing on versus whether or not it should be in the budget or not. I think it goes without saying that the police department here locally as well as nationally, for a wide variety of reasons, not even talking about protesting specifically, needs to be well equipped, armed, and ready for danger seen and unseen on a larger scale, just not talking about protesting.
You're listening to a special extended version of Charlotte Talks. We will join 1A in a few minutes, but we're here with Malcolm Graham from Charlotte City Council District 2, Braxton Winston, City Council at Large, Reverend Jay Leach from Unitarian Universalist Church, and Alvin Jacobs, a photographer. I know Reverend, you want to get into this, but I want to come back to Braxton for just a second because he's the one that's advocating that we take out of the arsenal things like tear gas and flashbangs and things like that. When you do that, when you remove the tools from the toolkit that police have to operate with, and I know Malcolm just said that it's about how you use these, not the fact that they exist, don't you cripple the police, Braxton? For some reason,
People have been dealing with public safety issues, crowd control, for thousands of years, ever since humanity existed, far long before weaponized CS gas was able to be canned and dispersed by the pull of a trigger. I would hope that our police also have plans for if they were to have to deal with a crowd and they did have any tear gas on hand. I think every community member's priority is public safety. That's what we speak about when we are out on the street demonstrating. And we have tactics that keep people safe. I think I have 22 hours of footage from September of 2016 of tactics that I and people around me employed to keep people safe in very difficult situations with no tear gas. I would also say that a person like me and protesters are out there subject to the same projectiles as everybody else. And I can tell you, especially Friday and other places, I did not feel myself at risk. I'm okay getting hit with a water bottle and a rock or two if I can help push our people forward. I don't need flashbangs and tear gas and pepper ball rounds to protect myself. I use my words, I use my body, And if we were able to do that, treat each other as human beings and not as other threats, we would be more successful and our community would be more safe.
Reverend.
I think one piece of this conversation that many of us have been calling for, I appreciate what Malcolm and Braxton are saying, and as the decision makers, we have to look to them. But what we've been calling for is a public conversation about policing, so that we as a community could have a conversation. We as a community could make decisions. Do we want our police carrying tear gas in our streets? Do we think that's a good idea? As Malcolm said, I'm not an expert either in policing. So let me hear the case for why tear gas is needed, why they need to engage in a tactic that's forbidden under the Geneva Convention in warfare, why that's necessary to do in the streets of Charlotte against unarmed people. Let's have a public conversation. Let's let the police come to us as a community and say, we need the following things. We need to be militarized in these ways. This is the reason why. We're going to explain our reasoning. We're going to lay it out before you. We're going to show you how your tax dollars are going to be used. And then let's have a public conversation. I'm all for CMPD going into communities and having get to know us conversations, but that's not the conversation we've been calling for. The conversation we've been calling for is a transparent conversation about how they are using tax dollars to police us. Let's talk about that as a community openly.
And I would say, that exists. And again, that's why I say you look at us. We are the city council. The budget process is where that happens. You know, that's, we will vote on a budget on next Monday. And we've gone through a public process where police are supposed to tell us why. We at Malcolm and I represent the voices, and we are supposed to be asking the questions and making them reach a bar to say, this is why we should be spending our tax dollars in this way. And I've, again, have tried to create processes where we have ability to go deeper, but we have not taken the opportunity to do that. We have the opportunity to do that between now and next Monday before City Council passes this budget.
As somebody pointed out, this is about process when it comes to the police, how they use the weaponry and when they choose to use the weaponry or the tactics that they have at their disposal. But it's also about leadership. And there have been some criticisms around the country of local leaders not being actively involved. We do have examples of police chiefs and sheriffs around in certain communities around the country going into the crowd at these protests, getting down on their knees with the protesters and joining them as one and telling the protesters, we're on your side, we recognize the problem. That has not happened in Charlotte, which I think is really interesting given the fact that we have Rodney McFadden as our sheriff, an African-American, and we have Kerr Putney as our police chief, an African-American. You have to focus, it seems to me, on the pain that is the undergirding problem here that we seem to be ignoring because we get all mixed up in the process of people telling you how much pain they're in through these protests. This came through during the conversation I played a portion of with the president yesterday with the governors. And the one governor that I'm aware of that took issue with the president was Democratic Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. He told the president that we need to focus on the root of this problem and not the tactics to combat it.
I've been extraordinarily concerned about the rhetoric that's been used by you. It's been inflammatory, and it's not okay for that officer to choke George Floyd to death. But we have to call for calm. We have to have police reform called for. We called out our National Guard and our state police. But the rhetoric that's coming out of the White House is making it worse. And I need to, you know, say that people are feeling real pain out there.
Okay, well, thank you very much, JB. I don't like your rhetoric much either because I watched it with respect to the coronavirus, and I don't like your rhetoric much either. I think you could have done a much better job, frankly.
When you have a fifth grade conversation with somebody in charge of the United States of America, does that fill you with hope for being able to get through this? Does it fill you with hope with how we will deal with a Republican National Convention that many believe, and now with this as backdrop, feel fairly certain that we will have major problems in Charlotte?
I think, and that's what I said earlier today, Mike and Alvin and Braxton and Jay, that it's really important for us to talk about what we're talking about here for the last hour, some of the specifics of what's going on in terms of how do we police, how do they use tactics, how they interact with the community. I think all those are extremely, extremely important, and those conversations need to be had. But the larger picture is that people all over this country are hurting. MLK said that rioting is the language of the unheard. They feel that they're not being heard over and over and over again. We have no moral leadership coming from Washington, D.C. The president himself is a part of the problem, a major part of the problem in terms of instigating violence and then weaponizing the federal government against peaceful protests. And I think we ought to, as Alvin has said earlier, call it what it is. I call it racism and hatred and discrimination and a lack for respect and for people that look like me on a wide variety of fronts, whether it's policing, whether it's employment, whether it's economic opportunity, whether it's healthcare, whether it's Jamaica from Johnson C. Smith with a 3.8 looking to get a job, but Janet from UNCC with the same transcript gets the job and she doesn't get an interview. It's all those institutional things that we're fighting with, and people are fed up. I'm fed up. And I wish there was an answer for your question, but I think the answer for me, as I tell my kids, is that we have to protest with our mind, our will, and the power of our vote.
I have 90 seconds left. Alexia McCammon, who is a political reporter for Axios, who just happens to be a black woman, recently pointed out, quote, "They don't like it when we protest. They don't like it when we suggest policy changes. They don't like it when we vote. It feels like there are no options left for how to move forward." Is that, in a nutshell, how members of the black community feel?
I agree with that statement.
This member of the black community feels that way.
I agree.
So how do we move forward? We have a minute left, less than a minute left. How do we move forward?
Well, you can go to votebraxton.com and sign up for updates. I will be sending emails about how to get involved and where to make real change in our city. So votebraxton.com and sign up.
We do it by our mind, our will, and the power of our vote. Go online and fill out your census form so you can be counted and be heard. If you're not registered to vote, vote. And again, peacefully march and protest for political, economic, and social change.
I want to thank all of you for being willing to stay a little extra longer today than we had normally planned for, but this is a conversation that needs to be had, and it needs to be longer than this, but we are out of time. Braxton Winston and Malcolm Graham from Charlotte City Council, Reverend Jay Leach from Unitarian Universalist Church, and photographer Alvin Jacobs, thank you all for joining us on Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.